Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 11 of Writers Aloud. This week, the poet and non-fiction writer Gwyneth Lewis discusses what it's like to be a poet and how she found herself in such a satisfying predicament. Following that, the poet, biographer, playwright and novelist Simon Ray considers the serendipitous progress of his multifaceted writing career. First, here's Gwyneth with What It's Like to Be a Poet.
For as long as I can remember, I've been desperate to be a poet. It feels like an illness from which I'm cured only by doing more of it. At certain times, not being able to write gave me a pain in my stomach. This desire has persisted through periods of good health, bad health, despite suggestions that I must be out of my mind to want such a thing, and despite people I love telling me that it was immoral of me, not wanting to write, but wanting to write more than I wanted them. My lovely husband Leighton has said from time to time that he knows he comes second to my writing. This made me feel like a heel. It's only recently, though, that we've understood that I also come second to my writing. To arrange one's life in order to service such a compulsion looks like selfishness. It takes a rare partner not to take umbrage and to accept that in the psychic pecking order of a marriage, this large thing I carry around with me, this camel's hump, isn't an attack on domestic intimacy, but a deformity which needs to be accommodated. We've widened the doors of our marriage and installed a non-standard shower, as it were, so that I and my hump at least don't smell. The compulsion started early. Brought up in a Welsh-speaking household, I wrote my first poem, age 7. It was a rhyming epic and described the rain. O, mae'n bwrw glaw, mae dŵr ar fy llaw, mae awr wedi mynd, o, dyma fy ffrind. Having been born in Wales, signs of a poetic disposition were pounced upon by parents and teachers. Writing could win you prizes. I was educated during the 1970s nationalist revival in education. To have young writers in Welsh gave people hope that the Welsh language was not in terminal decline. I had posters of Welsh poets on my wall, people with names like Waldo Williams, T.H. Parry Williams and R. Williams Parry. My sister had David Cassidy. I was educated in the strict metres, Cynghanedd, which influenced Gerard Manley Hopkins and Dylan Thomas. We'd go to a poet's house and compose quatrains on random subjects. I became embarrassed by a ribald joke made on the subject of the wheelbarrow and stopped going. I liked Hopkins and Shakespeare, and I knew I was a traitor. Poets are never innocent. We look at the world with a calculating eye. It's true my father taught me to speak English on the bottom step of our staircase, but the rest of this poem has good literary pedigree. From Welsh Espionage. Welsh was the mother tongue, English was his. He taught her the body by fetishist quiz, father and daughter on the bottom stair. De benelin, yw elbow. Dy walldi yw hair. Chin yw dy un di. Head yw dy ben. She promptly forgot. Made him do it again. Then he folded her dwrn and, calling it fist, held it to show her knuckles and wrist. Let's keep it from Mam as a special surprise. Lips a gwyfusau, llygaid our eyes. Each part he touched in their secret game, thrilled as she whispered its English name. The mother was livid when she was told, "We agreed no English till 4 years old." She listened upstairs, her head in a whirl. Was it such a bad thing to be Daddy's girl? Those of you who've read Henry V will remember the French princess teaching the young Prince Henry to speak French by using parts of the body. People, thinking that what a poet writes is honest, suspected I'd been sexually abused by my father. I told him this and offered to stop reading the poem in public. He very graciously said, "Carry on." Poems leaked out of me. It was embarrassing. Teachers didn't know any better than to give them praises and prizes, which I found offensive. I could knock up a good poem if one of my friends hadn't done her homework. In fact, that made me feel good. In Wales, you get to win chairs in Eisteddfod competitions. The small model ones were fine, but one year the woodwork teacher knocked up a hideous blue thing full size. To this day, my mother enjoys shedding her clothes onto it. Eventually, I rebelled and refused to write any more. I went to college in 1978 to read English. Nobody expected an undergraduate to write, and certainly then, being Welsh-speaking meant that Welsh poetry was off the cultural map. Because of personal difficulties, I took time out to get a job in the menswear department of Marks and Spencer and began to understand that, impossible though it seemed, writing might be part of the answer to my difficulties. If writing was the answer, what was the question? I'll park that one for a moment. I started to dare to write in English and learnt, to my cost, that you must never, never leave your scribbles lying around. A boyfriend found a poem I'd written about another man and understandably took it as a sign of emotional unfaithfulness. He wasn't wrong. So I learned to go undercover. The option of lying never occurred to me because I'd already understood that I was working with a demanding mechanism, one that would cut me off from its sources if I used it to tell anything less than the whole truth. Even, or perhaps especially, if that showed me in a less than flattering light. I remember walking at dusk one day and telling myself matter-of-factly that I'd really like to understand poetry one day. We went to hear the Soviet poet Andrei Voznesensky declaiming his poetry, using his arm as a pendulum, as if he was reciting to the clangour of great bells, which he was. The great Welsh poet R.S. Thomas came to read. I asked for an interview with him, but was too frightened to go alone. I hardly recognised myself. At his reading, I heard him contradict a questioner who'd asserted that Dante is the imagination of Christendom. "No," he said. Was he wearing his dog collar or not? I don't remember. "Christ is the imagination of Christendom." What that means, I'm still in the process of finding out. Recently, I heard Kay Ryan, the former American poet laureate, describing the moment she knew she wanted to be a poet. She was on a long bike ride across the United States, coming up to a pass with glorious views all around. Her internal voice asked, "So, should I be a poet?" And she heard a reply, "Do you like it?" A laureateship and a Pulitzer Prize later, the answer must have been yes. But what is that dialogue which has such authority with her and which led her to change her life? Recently, I addressed a group of hospital chaplains at their conference in Leeds and spoke to them about the vocation of being a poet. I said it was like struggling to hear something that's difficult to perceive, but that's of a better quality than our normal trivial self-talk. How do we distinguish between wishful thinking and high-value information? It's easy when what I'm listening to goes against my habitual thought, which runs along the lines, "I'm useless, we're doomed, what's the point?" You get the idea. So if I say, "My theme is change, my point of view ecstatic. See how speed transforms us? Didn't you know that time's a fiction?" I accept it because it scans. But scanning in itself isn't enough. Form, as the director Peter Brook writes, decays. You have to run ahead of it. I'm listening, but for what? Words, yes, but they can get in the way. They're nothing in themselves, but they ride on waves of something like music behind them. Are these movements the pre-linguistic self reaching towards language? And in Welsh writing, poetry is referred to as composition. So what, when I'm writing, am I composing? Yes, words which have a satisfying feel, but these are no more than the marks left on a dance floor compared to the internal dance performed by the writer, partnered by what? Now, there's the rub. Both God and the devil are good dancers. This moral discernment is never talked about in poetry circles, but it's at the centre of what I do every day because writing for me is like being on a high wire. Because I suffer from depression, I'm lucky enough to have little margin of safety and no net beneath me. First, it allows me to see others. Second, it shows me that I'm never alone. Speech is catching. If the liturgy, as American writer Annie Dillard has written, is a well-trodden path through a minefield, then if I ride piggyback on, say, Robert Frost or Seamus Heaney or Anne Carson, I'm in good company. What I copy from them isn't their words, but their gait. What does it like? Everything children do. What does it hate? Laziness, cliché. Everything that isn't given for free, for its own sake. It particularly hates ambition. It's nothing less than a kind of being with God. So what does the poem compose if it's more than art? It certainly changes the poet, and if you do your job rightly, it changes the reader. As Rainer Maria Rilke wrote in his poem to the archaic torso of Apollo, Du musst dein Leben ändern. You must change your life. So, as I'm trying to get my lines to scan, what's being composed is me. My great fear about being a poet has been working on my own, but what I've discovered is that I submit myself to a discipline which turns out to be highly social. And to what authorities do I submit? Yes, I hear the voices of the past and I attend to how people speak now. Be careful what you say to a writer, by the way, it might end up in print. But even more, I'm moving towards an entity which I can't, in the normal run of things, quite distinguish. It's described by the German poet Paul Celan like this. The poem intends another, needs this other, needs an opposite. It goes towards it, bespeaks it. For the poem, everything and everybody is a figure of this other toward which it is heading. Now, I'm terrible for leading on a dance floor and have to learn to be led. So what am I following? Melody? Yes, but not quite. Emotion? I'm certainly tracking the movements of the mind as it falls in and out of language. And what is its reward? No more and no less than being here with you.
That was Gwyneth Lewis, recorded by Julia Copus. You can find out more about Gwyneth on her website at www.gwynethlewis.com. That's Gwyneth, spelt G-W-Y-N. Next, here's Simon Ray on his pluralistic writing career.
Career? Checkered at best, but at least I have kept writing, just not the same things. A novelist can point to the shelf of titles that have made his or her name, bulked out with collections of short stories perhaps, or selections of occasional pieces. The playwright's study will be wallpapered with theatre posters, and even the poet will have a dozen or so thin volumes, possibly end-stopped by selected poems, to show for a lifetime's dedication to the art. As for biographers, their vast works stand like hewn sarsen stones, brooding monuments to the mystery of human endeavour. Most people are content to be one or possibly two kinds of writer, but not me. Poet, playwright, biographer, and latterly novelist. So, jack of all trades, master of none. The funny thing is, even at this late stage, I still think the jury's out. As with all previous career changes, my most recent, to storytelling for younger readers, thrills me with the highest expectations. As always, I believe everything I write is going to be a huge success. The jack of all trades could still hit the jackpot. But I would readily concede I have followed a remarkably indirect career path, depending, now I come to think of it, on a series of quite random encounters, accidents and connections. I owed my chance to become the presenter of Radio 4's Poetry Please programme to my friend Wendy Cope's disinclination to engage with Shelley. I owed my position as The Guardian's resident poet to my friend Richard Boston's decision to review Vikram Seth's narrative poem The Golden Gate in verse, only to discover in the cold light of day that he wasn't a poet. However, I was, and as he had smuggled me into Alan Rusbridge's spare bedroom after I'd missed the last train home, I was able to write Richard's copy for him, impressing the future editor of The Guardian while I was doing so. And I owed my career as a biographer to the chairman of Faber and Faber, Matthew Evans, or to his love of cricket, or to the accident of his getting stuck in traffic, turning on the radio to allay his boredom, and listening to one of the drama documentaries I occasionally wrote for Radio 4. This one was a light-hearted and very lightly researched look at the development of the laws of cricket. The burly figure of W.G. Grace loomed large, causing Matthew to wonder when the last biography of England's greatest cricketer had been published. It had been a while, apparently, and within a week I was presented with the opportunity to supply the perceived want. It was an offer I couldn't refuse, although I was painfully aware that the few minutes of Grace material in my programme was more or less the sum of my knowledge. One thing I did know was that 1998 would mark the 150th anniversary of the great man's birth. I had no time to lose. It took me 2 years and 2 months to research and write the 500 pages of my biography. During those 2 years I travelled widely in the UK, and even got on a plane to follow in Grace's footsteps across Australia. I was the first biographer to do this, and I turned up a succession of scandals which showed that, far from being an ambassador for the noble game, Grace was as piratical and rapacious as any of the great figures of Victorian expansionism. Not only was he arrogant and duplicitous when dealing with his Australian hosts, he was not above bullying his own motley party of cricketers. And I am as sure as one can be that on one occasion he forced his mutinous professionals back onto the team stagecoach at gunpoint. Research is enormous fun, indeed dangerously addictive. I think I'd still be doing it now had it not been for that unmissable deadline. I set a date for writing to begin, then carried on burrowing through libraries and archives like a demented bookworm. But in the end, the dread day came. I had my notes. I had the entire floor of my writing room covered in a crazy paving of notes. I had many volumes porcupined with multicoloured post-its. I had almanacs of ancient cricket scores and averages. I had photocopies of long-forgotten correspondence. I knew, I reckoned, I was wrong, more about W.G. Grace than anyone else on the planet. And now it was time to start my magnum opus. Oh, the horror of that morning in my garret above the ancient streets of Devizes. I fired up my computer, I called up a new file. The blank screen shimmered with possibility. I raised my hands like a concert pianist about to launch into a Rachmaninoff concerto. But instead of a cascade of dazzling brilliance, nothing. I found my fingers had turned to chipolatas and my brain to mince. It took me all morning to get Grace born and equip him with parents and grandparents. And when the nearby church clock struck the appointed hour for lunch, I tottered down the old elm staircase and collapsed in my little cottage's kitchen, completely shattered. Biography is hard work, extremely hard work. I survived that terrible first morning. I got into my story and into my stride, and I wrote my 500 pages to meet the tightest of deadlines. but the effort must have pulled a muscle in my head. When people asked, "Who are you going to do next?" I looked at them with the blurred focus of a boxer staggering out of the ring. It didn't matter that I had won my bout, that I had gone 15 rounds with the champion. I was done. Battered, bruised, exhausted. Jack Hobbs, Walter Hammond, Ranjit Singhji, no. I was never going to climb back into the ring and go the distance with any of those heavyweights. I might have written a definitive biography, but it was definitively my last. At the behest of my publishers, I did write a second, much shorter cricket book, which largely reprised my original radio programme on the darker side of the noble game. But it involved no original research, gave me little pleasure, and drew down the shutters on the non-fiction phase of my picaresque journey through the genres. I never abandoned poetry, and in fact won the National Poetry Competition in 1999. However, after a daunting but rewarding collaboration on a book of poems with Ronald Searle, I turned to writing plays. My first, A Quiet Night In, was set on the eve of the millennium, another unforgiving deadline. Indeed, one of the characters, a historian with a commission to write a history of the 20th century, has missed it. Stopping him committing suicide is one of the challenges faced by the couple he drops by on, drunk and brandishing a revolver. Another is deciding whether, in fact, they are going to attempt to start a family. All good knockabout stuff, which had audiences laughing in slightly uneasy recognition both in Bristol and London. Is there anything better than sitting in a darkened space, listening to complete strangers laughing at your dialogue? On the nights when the laughter was gale force, I thought not. On the quieter nights, I had my doubts. But these weren't strong enough to deter me from persisting with this latest career tangent. Another of the dramatised documentaries I had written in my BBC days was on the poet John Clare. When I was asked for a short play about a romantic poet, I was happy to revise that for the stage, rewriting it and setting the troubled rural poet in our contemporary world of aggressive agribusiness and, in the early years of the century, an outbreak of foot-and-mouth disease that produces a nightmare landscape of burning cattle through which Clare wanders, bewildered on his escape from his lunatic asylum. With Clare played brilliantly by ex-RSC actor David Keller, Grass was a tour de force. We took the play up to Edinburgh, and I was hooked. Drama is even more addictive than research, and, like gambling, you always think the next round of play will be the one that breaks the bank. 10 years on, in the thick of the worst financial crisis in living memory, it was my bank that was broken. Theatre is very expensive, and it had become a luxury I could no longer afford. Time for Plan B. What I needed was a bestseller. A novel that would have queues forming all the way round Waterstones to the happy ka-chinging of cash registers. And so the latest phase of my writing life began. What should my bestseller be about? Cricket, I decided. A popular novel about cricket, brought out to coincide with the next Ashes series. That should do the trick. In no time at all, aided by a robust bottle of Australian Red, I had the story mapped out. Tom Marlin suffers an unpleasant, and not so accidental, accident playing football at school. When he comes back after a lengthy break, he chooses cricket as his summer term option, largely out of bravado to show Devlin, the school bully, he won't be intimidated. What neither he nor his tormentor expects is that, through some quirk of the surgery to repair his shoulder, he has emerged with a golden arm, capable of producing tremendous spin on a cricket ball and making him virtually unplayable. What's extraordinary is that the next day I actually started writing it down. No blank page stage fright this time. I simply started with the football incident and ploughed on, page after page after page. I was lost in the story and my fingers flew over the keyboard. It was exhilarating and all I wanted to do was to keep on doing it. I was helped by the fortuitous invitation to a luxury retreat in the Caribbean. With worries and distractions left on the other side of the Atlantic, and waited on hand and foot, all I had to do was keep telling the story, with the odd break for a poolside drink as a reward for progress. And progress was heartening. Just under 77,000 words in just over 7 weeks, start to finish. Unplayable, there was really nothing else I could have called it, wasn't a bestseller. But for a first and self-published novel, it did pretty well. Nicholas Lezard picked it for his column in the Guardian Review. Jonathan Agnew, interviewing me on Test Match Special, mused kindly that I might be cricket's J.K. Rowling. I also sold the film option. Not, alas, taken up, they seldom are. But good for morale, nonetheless. Sales comfortably covered the printing costs, and when I started looking for someone to publish my next book, Unplayable made a persuasive calling card. I sent it to David Fickling, who liked it enormously, and in the fullness of time, he commissioned two further titles, Keras, which came out in 2013, and Medusa's Butterfly, 2014. With, I hope, more to follow. Because this is definitely what I want to do now. It's a tremendous thing to embark on something so completely different. At the age when most writers have a pretty good idea of where they stand, my career has just shot off at an unpredicted tangent, again, opening the vista of a new promised land, indeed, a never-never land, of pirates, unicorns, zombies, robots, ghosts, you name it. Who knows, perhaps I will achieve a shelf of novels. After all, I'm only 117 titles behind Michael Morpurgo.
That was Simon Ray, recorded by Carol Angier. You can find out more about Simon on the RLF website. His surname is spelled R-A-E. And that concludes episode 11, which was produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 12, the non-fiction writer and memoirist Frances Spufford speaks with Carol Angier about the joys of reading and writing and the importance of the senses. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.